Hello, everyone. I hope you can hear me fine. We've got a couple of people here today, and so I'm going to try and go through one at a time and unmute you just to say hi. So, Jared, are you there? Jared, hello. Can you hear us? Well, maybe he's not ready yet. Karen, are you there? Hello, Karen?
Hi.
Hi. Welcome to our webinar.
Thank you.
Let's see. Mary Bell, hello. Are you there? I can hear an echo. Hey, Nicole, are you there?
Yes. Hi, BL.
Good morning. I hope you've had a cup of coffee. What time is it there? 5:30?
6 o'clock.
Ah, you got to sleep
not
in.
Too bad. Yes, exactly. That's early for me.
Well, welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Victor. Are you there? Victor?
Yeah.
Hello. Welcome again. You're always a regular. It's good to see you. Hi, Walter. Are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Good to see you again.
Likewise.
Hi, Yvonne.
Hi, BL. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. How are you doing?
Really great. Thank you.
Good. Okay, now let's go back up and see if we can get Jared. Hi, Jared. Are you there? Nope. I still can't hear you, Jared, but we're glad to see you here. I know you're a new student, so welcome.
There's Annie.
Yeah. Hi, Annie. Welcome.
Hi there, BL. How are you?
I'm doing real good.
It's good to be with you. I just ran from another place to catch us. I was so glad to find I hadn't started yet.
Oh, we're just saying hi to everybody, so I'm glad to see everybody here. As we do with most of our webinars nowadays, I want to briefly go over a little bit of our noise protocol. I'm going to keep everybody on mute because otherwise we get a lot of that echo and stuff. So when you want to say something, you can raise your hand. There should be a little block right here. It's not in my picture, but it's in this vicinity here. That you can see in the middle of my screen that has the little hand that you raise and then lower if you want to ask a question. Then at that time, we will unmute you. It's also a good idea to self-mute, keep yourself on self-mute, and that way we can minimize as much as possible the interference in the broadcast. Okay? There's also, if you need to, an opportunity for you to type messages down here if we're not seeing your hand. I've got several people helping me on the staff today. Kay is there, Eva is there, and Brett is there. So they're helping me watch for things like the hands and messages and stuff that you've got. Also, there is a delay because we're from all different parts of the world, so I'll say something and expecting a reply back from you, but it may be a minute or two. Well, not a minute or two, but several seconds before the delay will kick in, and the same will happen when I get a response from you. So, we're going to start the labors of Hercules. is, of course, based on the articles that Alice Bailey first printed in the Beacon magazine or periodical, and then it was later published in the book, The Labors of Hercules. I want to thank Victor for asking this question last week, and now I've gone through and changed my slides that I put in here to elaborate a little bit more on why we study the Hercules myth. It not only shows us the progress of the disciple through the heavens as he has, you know, these tests in each individual sign, but it also shows us that this progress is not just limited to disciples. Every single person has all signs in their chart. Some are represented better than others, some we hardly realize that we even have, but we all have them in our chart, and we all experience these little tests, maybe not to the level that Hercules has, because he is a disciple, so he's mastered these signs, and now he's taking the final tests in these signs. But still, there is so much that each and every one of us can learn by reading about Hercules' journeys through the 12 signs. For us mere mortals, we start off learning about the lower expression of each sign, but eventually we begin to face the higher level of these energies that Hercules is going through. So by looking at the myth each month, by studying the information that we're given not only in the myth itself, but in the text that goes along with it, the interpretation of the myth, the lessons learned, how this particular sign matches to the cross that it's on, how it interacts with its polar opposite sign. Those are all good things for us to know just for general reasons. And if you take the myth and try and correlate it with the astrology book that you get in the various different levels of the classes, I think you'll see how we all learn from the lessons that Hercules can teach us. Those of us that are astrologers, we like to look at the myths. You know, it's not an accident that they named some of these planets and asteroids what they named it, that these constellations in the sky are named what they are. The correlations of the myth to the person, to the sign, we see that in many different cultures. So it's very helpful in understanding astrology. It's very helpful in understanding psychology. So it's all part and parcel of understanding who we are through our astrological energies as depicted by Hercules through these labors. I was trying to make this as big as I could, but I'm getting a little... Okay. Hercules always starts off with the presiding one, or the each labor starts off with that. So in this particular one, in the Cancer labor, the great presiding one, sitting in the council chamber of the Lord, spoke to Hercules' teacher. Where is the Son of Man, who is the Son of God? How fares he? How is he tested, and with what service is he now engaged? And the teacher replies, not at this time, O great presiding one. The third great test provided much of teaching sustenance to a learner such as he. He ponders and reflects. Provide a test which will evoke his wisest choice. Send him to labor in a field wherein he must decide which voice of all the many voices will arouse the obedience of his heart. Provide likewise a test of great simplicity upon the outer plane, and yet a test which will awaken on the inner side of life the fullness of his wisdom and rightness of his power to choose. Let him proceed with the fourth test. Before the fourth great gate stood Hercules, standing in deep silence. He observed the landscape around him silently and saw the temple of the Lord, the shrine of the sun god. On a hill nearby stood a slender fawn, and Hercules, watching the fawn, heard a voice. It was Artemis, the goddess of the moon, warning him that the doe belonged to her, and he was not to touch it. For ages she had nurtured it, and so she claimed it. But then Diana, the goddess of the forest, leapt up and claimed the doe was hers. Artemis and Diana argued back and forth, each claiming possession of the doe. Hercules, still standing between the pillars of the gate, listened to their quarrel, wondering about the two maidens. And then he heard another voice, a commanding voice, telling him the doe belonged to the shrine and neither maiden. And so he listened to this new voice, and he was instructed to rescue the doe and bear it to the shrine. And so Hercules starts on his journey. Artemis and Diana watch him this whole time, and they hamper him wherever they can whenever he gets close to the doe. They deluded Hercules, seeking to throw him off as he chased the doe from point to point. And thus, for the length of a full year, he followed the doe from place to place, catching glimpses of it, only to find nothing time after time. But then he finally found it sleeping beside a pool of water in the forest. He quietly crept up on it and shot his arrow, hitting the doe's foot, wounding it. As he drew close, he picked the doe up in his arms and held it close to his heart, while Artemis and Diana watched. He cried in exultation that the doe was his, and when he heard the other voice again, the voice of the teacher reminding him that the doe belongs to no one, and commanding him to carry it to the shrine. Hercules asked why, when the doe was his, carried close to his heart. And the teacher told him, as a son of God, he dwelled within the shrine of God, and he needed to bring the doe there for everyone else who shared with the shrine. So Hercules listens to this voice. He takes the doe to the holy shrine of Mycenae, and Hercules lays it in the center of the shrine. But seeing the wound on the doe, he again thinks, "This is mine. Through the skill of the hunt, I caught this doe. It's mine." And then another argument ensues with Artemis and Diana, who were following him. So all three are claiming the doe is theirs. But then Apollo, the sun god, speaks from the holy place, claiming the doe for the holy shrine. "Why," asked Artemis, "can Hercules enter this temple, but Diana and Artemis couldn't, even when he had killed the doe?" And Apollo answered that it was because Hercules bore the doe in his arms, close to his heart, and he left it in the holy place to find rest. And that's what man does in the holy place. So Hercules, returning from the test, passed through the gate again and found his way back to the teacher of his life. Hercules tells his teacher that the task was fulfilled and was simple, except for the time it took to do it. He said the doe was in the holy place, close to the heart of God, but also close to Hercules' own heart. "Go look again, O Hercules, my son, between the pillars of the gate," said his teacher. And sure enough, beyond the gate, on a nearby hill, stood a new fawn. Hercules, puzzled, asked why the fawn was back. This time it was the presiding one who answered. "Again and yet again must all the sons of men, who are the sons of God, seek for the golden-antlered fawn and bear it to the holy place. again and yet again. His teacher told Hercules that the fourth labor was over, but that the nature of the test was a frequent search for the dough. Okay, so that's the basic myth. Any questions here before I go on to the meaning of the myth?
Yes, it's Eva here, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I maybe you covered this in previous webinars, but I'm wondering from our esoteric perspective, who the teacher is and who the presiding one is.
He does give names when he's describing the later events, and I believe, my understanding is, and I'm sorry, I have trouble with some of these Greek names, Eurythius is actually the teacher, and I forget the name, but in one of the earlier ones, he does give the name of the presiding one as well. But for the most part, he just refers to them as the teacher and the presiding one. You know, in Hercules, as he begins each labor, the presiding one and his teacher have a discussion about how he's doing. The teacher explains to him the nature of his mission. Your mission, should you decide to accept, is to, and on Hercules goes, and then he has to come back and report to his teacher, who then reports to the presiding one. And of course, the presiding one, you know, these are his masters. You can look at them also as his solar angels, his higher self. They're there watching, just as we know when we study the path that, you know, we've got a master up there who's watching us when we get to the point where something we do, the energies of it can then reach him. You know, he's not interested in our mundane life. He's only right. interested in the progression of our soul. And that's what these, both of them, the teacher and the presiding one, represent.
And that's how I've always put it in my own mind, is that the teacher is the solar angel and the presiding one would be the master of the ashram and so on. So that
right.
that's how I've always sort of substituted those words in my head.
Yeah, and that's pretty much kind of what I do too. Although he does actually give them names. And I haven't sat down and gone through, you know, Greek mythology to see who these people are. I know the biggies, you know. but I don't know some of the less obvious of the Greek pantheon there. So,
but I always find it helpful for me anyway to be able to correlate the myths to what we study and what we understand from an esoteric perspective. So for me, it always helps me better understand what
when you put it in that context.
Yeah.
Right.
So thank you very much.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the most important things I find when I read these labors is the myth is interesting. You know, it's pretty cool. But it's the dialogue that he has afterwards where he talks about what the myth means and puts it into terms that we can understand, which we will then be going through.
Right.
Okay. So, Cancer is actually, as we see on the screen here, the last of the four preparatory signs, whether we're considering involution of the soul in matter or evolution of the aspirant as he struggles out of the human into the spiritual kingdom. So being equipped with the faculty of mind, as he was in Aries, and with desire, as he was in Taurus, and having arrived at the realization of his essential duality in Gemini, the incarnating human enters through birth in Cancer into the human kingdom. And Cancer is a mass sign, and the influences bring about the formation of the human family, the race, the nation, and the family unit. For aspirant, these four signs prepare and equip and show him how to use, how to grip the mind and seek to bend it to his needs, learning mental control in Aries. He receives that first flash of spiritual light, which will grow increasingly more brilliant in Taurus. He realizes the two parts of himself and that the one wanes and the other waxes in Gemini. And in Cancer, he gets his first touch of that universal sense, which is the higher aspect of the mass consciousness. So we can see the involution as he fell into matter and how those four signs prepped him. And then the evolution as he's returning to spirit and how they prep him on the higher spiral. I've got questions here. Okay. Nicole, let's go to you first. Nicole?
No. Yes, BL. I'm
yes.
Here.
Uh-huh.
I was only going to add a comment to Eva's question.
Okay.
Because I always considered the teacher as the one who's responsible for us. And I think it was in Letters of in Occult Meditation or Psych 2, I'm not quite sure, but DK mentions three disciples who is responsible for us. One, the disciple who's responsible for our emotional or astral evolution, if you like. The other one is the mental development. And the third one is the spiritual. And I'm wondering, or rather, I've always wondered if the teacher that he's mentioning here is not the one or the synthetic teacher who is sort of responsible for the student, could be an adept or something like this, who then relates the information or the evolution to then the presiding one, who is perhaps the master of the ashram. So I just wanted to add.
Sure, thank you. I appreciate that.
Felt.
You know, and you know, that's one of the things we study on the, in the path classes, is that there's you know, different levels of disciples and cellas and aspirants, and each one helps the people who are in the lower level than them, until you get to the point where you can sustain the energy of the master. You can live within that energy field, and because you're expressing that too. So yeah, that's a good point, that there are disciples responsible for the teaching of the lower aspirants until they reach that higher level. So yeah, I think there's several different ways to look at it. The point being that there is that teacher looking at us, helping us in the journey. So thank you for that, Nicole. Let's go to Yvonne. Yvonne, you had a question or comment?
Yes. What's the, he shot the doe in the leg. What is the significance of that? Why did he have to do that?
Well, he had to capture it, number one. But there's several significances that you see of that. And he does talk, DK talks, or Alice Bailey talks later on when describing the myth, about the similarity between the Achilles heel. You know, that was where they held Achilles when he was dipped in, and therefore all of him was protected except for that heel. So I think it's just another one of those correlations that we all have in some way or another our Achilles heel, and that was the doves.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions before we go on? Nicole and Yvonne, do you both want to lower your hands? Okay. So where were we? Equipped, therefore, with a controlled mind, a capacity to register illumination, and an ability to connect his immortal aspect and intuitively recognize the kingdom of spirit, he is now ready for the greater work. So three words basically summarize self-awareness, or the consciousness aspect of the evolving human being: instinct, intellect, and intuition. Cancer is predominantly the sign of instinct, but it's the sublimation of instinct that becomes our intuition. In the same way, as matter has to be lifted up into heaven, so instinct has to be likewise lifted up. And when it has been transcended and transmuted, it manifests as intuition, symbolized here in the myth by the doe. The intermediate stage is that of the intellect. The great need of Hercules now is to develop his intuition and to become familiar with the instantaneous recognition of truth and reality, which is the higher prerogative and the potent factor in the life of a liberated son of God. Okay, so in actuality, the doe was all three things. It was first instinct, then it was intellect, and then it becomes intuition as he searches for each one of those things along the way. Any questions before we move on? Okay, Walter. Yes, Walter.
Yeah, yes. Interestingly, I learned about the myth in one slightly alternate version where, interestingly, this was the capturing the doe was the only one of the 12 labors technically not completed as assigned. That means that Hercules was supposed to capture or even kill the doe, and he almost did, but when he was about to deal the death blow, that was when the goddess appeared and told him that it was sacred and that he couldn't slay it, but that she would tell Eurystheus, or the aspect assigning the labors, that Hercules had completed it. And I was thinking that, the point of this alternate version is that, it does support what's been presented so far. In other words, you can't capture or own on an individual level the intuition, but rather the only thing that can be done with something so vast like that is we can only put it in the shrine for the benefit of all, or for the one being.
Right, and that's why he had to do it over and over and over again. And every time he did it, he turned around and there was another fawn on the hill.
Indeed.
Yeah. Thank you, Walter.
Thank you.
Okay. So Hercules was sent to capture the doe, something that was elusive and difficult to secure. And it represented all three words, as I was just talking about. There is no success for the aspirant until he has transmuted instinct into intuition, nor is there right use of the intellect until the intuition is brought into play, interpreting and extending the intellect and bringing realization. Then instinct becomes subordinate to both. One of the things that is often forgotten is that there are no sharp distinctions between the various aspects of man's nature, but all are phases of the one reality. Instinct, intellect, and intuition are varying aspects of the consciousness and of the response to the environment and to the world in which the human being finds himself. Man, the animal, possesses instinctual response to his environment. Instinct is the consciousness of the form and of the cell life, the mode of awareness of the form, and therefore it's Artemis, the moon, who rules over the form. That's why she was there That's why she thought the doe was hers. Yes, Nicole.
I've been wondering about Yvonne's question, which I thought was very intriguing. Yes, why does he have to shoot her? Because we see in the myth that the doe is sleeping very quietly.
The doe was exhausted like Hercules was.
Correct. Correct. So therefore, he didn't have to shoot her. But I thought that this question was very intriguing until I thought of Cancer being the sign of endings. And here, I think there's DK is equating death and sleep, and because this is a cardinal sign, labor is a cardinal sign, therefore it has a lot to do with spirit, and spirit for us is that Ray One, the will, and one of the qualities of the will is the withdrawal of the life force. And therefore, sleep and death is the same, except that in death, well, there's a complete withdrawal of the life force, whereas sleep, it's only a temporary, it's only the life thread is not severed, as in death, it's only the consciousness thread which is severed. Or at least withdrawn on an inner level. So I thought, yeah, I think maybe that's what DK is trying to tell us there.
Well, he actually goes in. I'm almost coming to the point where he talks about the hunt.
Mm-hmm.
It represents the mental aspect. But you're right, you know, Cancer is the gate into incarnation, and that involves the form, number one, but it also involves the repeated deaths and rebirths and the pause in between that the sleep represents. So there are so many different levels to the metaphor of this particular labor, that all of those things are represented of it. So thank you for sharing that. I think that brings just as much insight as to what he continues to say when he's discussing this labor. So thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, let's see here. Through Artemis, the moon rules over the form. So he's also a human being, rational. He can analyze. He can criticize. He possesses that something which we call the mind and that faculty of intellectual perception and response which opens him up to new fields of awareness, but which is nevertheless simply an extension of his response apparatus and the development of instinct into intellect. Through the One, he becomes aware of the world of physical contacts and of emotional conditions, and through the Other, he becomes aware of the world of thought and of ideas, and thus is a human being. When he has reached the stage of intelligent and instinctual awareness, then his teacher points him to the other world of which he can become equally aware, but which has its own method of contact and its own response apparatus. This is where Diana the Huntress claimed the doe, because to her it is the intellect and man is the great seeker, the great hunter before the Lord. But the doe had another and more elusive form, and Hercules, as the aspirant, also looked for this. So for a life cycle, he hunted, represented in the myth as a year. Finally, he captured it, and following his spiritual intuition, he carried it into the temple, where it was claimed by the sun god, Apollo. Intuition, that highly developed sense of awareness, which gives to the disciple a vision of new fields of contact and opens up for him a new world of being. We're told that the battle is still going on between Apollo, the sun god, who knew that the doe was the intuition, between Diana, the huntress of the heavens, who knew it was intellect, and between Artemis, the moon, who thought it was only instinct. Remember at the end there, when he looked back and saw the fawn, he could hear the argument ongoing. Wait a minute, where was I? The problem of all disciples is to use the instinct correctly in all its right place and its proper way. He must learn to use the intellect, and through it becomes conscious of the world of human ideas and research. He must learn to carry that capacity into the temple of the Lord and there to transmute it to intuition. And through the intuition, become aware of the things of the spirit and those spiritual realities which neither instinct nor intellect can reveal to him. And again, the sons of men must recapture these spiritual realities upon the endless way. So this is why he hunts. It's representing the intellect. It's representing that search for the next level. And you have to conquer that level. So in my mind, that is why he has to at least wound the doe. He has to conquer the doe and bring it to the temple over and over again. So, Nicole, does that play then on what your comments? Yeah. And Yvonne?
Yes, it does clarify that, yeah.
Okay, great. Yvonne, does that help clarify for you?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Do you have another question? Okay. Anybody else have any questions or comments before we move on? Isn't it wonderful how he just went through and explained all of that? Okay. Let's go on to...
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
It's Eva.
Uh-huh.
I don't have a hands up, so sorry, I have to interject. Okay, I just want to add one little thing here, since we're talking about the three eyes that the Tibetan always emphasizes, that here he goes on to tell us in that particular part that you explained, those three eyes, how we move and developmentally through instinct, then intellect, and then the intuition. And those are the three levels that we move through. So, of course, you just said that we should not be using our instinct and our intellect, but move into the intuition as we evolve more and more.
Actually, my understanding of it was we use the instinct and the intellect, but that they're subordinate to the intuition.
Right, right.
In other words, we continue to use all three.
Yeah, we always use all three, but our aim is to try to move into the intuition, which is, of course, a higher level.
Right, that's on the Buddhic level.
Right.
The fourth subplane of the fourth plane. And this is our Cancer, the fourth sign. Correct. So who says numerology doesn't work, right?
Right, correct. That's excellent.
Okay, let's look at the qualities of the sign. Cancer is called the crab, and the Greeks tell us that it was the crab that was sent by Hera to bite the foot of Hercules. Again, we think of the symbol as the vulnerable heel of Achilles. So that brings us back to what your question was, Yvonne. Why wounded and why there? This is an interesting way of expressing the liabilities of the incarnation process and of illustrating the handicaps that we endure as we tread the path of evolution. And I think this emphasizes your point, Nicole. You know, this is all part of that incarnation process of experiencing death in the various different forms of it. It symbolizes the limitations of all physical incarnation, for Cancer is one of the two great gates of the zodiac. It is the gate into the world of form, physical incarnation, and the sign wherein the duality of form and the soul is unified in the physical body. The opposite sign to Cancer is Capricorn, and these two constitute the two gates, one being the gate into form, and the other into the spiritual life, one opening the door into the mass form of the human family, and the other into the universal state of consciousness, which is the kingdom of spirit. One marks the beginning of the human experience on the physical plane, and the other marks its climax. One signifies potentiality, and the other consummation. We are told that Christ gave to Saint Peter the keys of the heavens and earth. He gave to him, therefore, the keys of these two gates. We read, quote, Jesus gives to Peter the keys of the two principal gates of the zodiac, which are the two solstice points, the zodiac signs of Cancer and Capricorn, called the gates of the sun. Through Cancer, or the gate of man, the soul descends upon earth to unite with the body, which is spiritual death. Through Capricorn, the gate of the gods, it reascends to heaven. Exoterically, Cancer is ruled by the moon, which is the mother of form, controlling the water and the tides. Therefore, in this sign, the form is dominant and constitutes a handicap. The crab builds its house or shell and carries it upon his back, and people born in this sign are always conscious of that which they have built. They are usually oversensitive, over-emotional, ever seeking to hide away. The Cancer native is so sensitive that he is difficult to handle and so elusive and sometimes so indefinite that it is hard to understand him or pin him down. Esoterically, Cancer is ruled by Neptune, who is the god of waters. So here we see that the two rulers of this sign, the moon and Neptune, you have the symbol of a close relationship between the mother of all forms and the god of the waters. In this esoteric marriage, you have pictured for humanity a major synthesis of form and desire sensitivity, and consequently, a true statement of the stage of consciousness, which we call the Atlantean. There is much of this today, and of this stage, mass sensitivity and mass identification with form, and with form is the significant indication and the outstanding characteristic of Cancer and its subjects. It is interesting to contrast the two signs, Cancer and Capricorn, for that which is indicated in Cancer is consummated in Capricorn. Cancer represents the home, the mother, it's personal and emotional. Capricorn represents the group, which is the unit consciously enters, and also the father of all that is. So the gate of Cancer is entered through the process of transference out of the animal state of consciousness into the human, while the gate of Capricorn is entered through initiation. One is an inevitable subconscious and potential, and the other is self-initiated, self-conscious, and potent. Cancer admits the soul into the world which we call humanity, while Capricorn admits the soul into the conscious participation in the life of the world center that we call hierarchy. Any comments on that before I go on to the cardinal cross? Yes, Nicole. Nicole?
Yeah, this, the water is, yes, I'm here. Can
okay.
you hear me?
Yes.
I was wondering about Cancer being a water sign, and that has troubled me for quite a while. As the soul comes into form, and then I realized that the soul, being the second aspect of divinity, as it's the middle point between the monad and the personality, he will be immersed in form in water, which is also the second aspect of divinity. The astral plane is the midpoint or the intermediary between the mental and the physical. So that, I just wanted to share that with you because I was wondering for a long time, why does, you know, why is the soul immersed in the sea, and these aspects, the second aspect of divinity made sense to me. So I don't know whether it makes sense to anybody else, but it certainly made sense to me.
Yes, and thank you for bringing that point up. I agree, you know. It's sometimes not readily apparent why Cancer is a water sign, but the crab is actually can live in both water and land. And so it's not only the middle point, as you're saying, between the astral and the buddhic with the mental there in between, but it's also the middle point between earth and water here. And Cancer has all of that sensitivity. It's one of the most sensitive of all the signs. And sensitivity is a very watery astral thing. So that's actually both the moon and Neptune participating there in that. But yeah, you know, sometimes you wonder, are these just arbitrary assignments of the elements? Well, no, they're not. There really is a hidden reason in there behind that. So thank you for pointing out some of those there. Any other comments?
We have, yes.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'd just like to add to that. What we have to realize or to constantly bear in mind is that this is a second solar system. Therefore, it's the development of the second aspect of divinity, which is absolutely crucial for us to remember. We keep forgetting. Right?
Right.
Keep forgetting.
And that second aspect is consciousness, and that's what this sign is all about.
That's right.
That's different levels.
Is about the mass sensitivity. In the second, or rather in the first solar system, it was the material form aspect, or the third aspect of divinity, which was developed. Whereas in this, the soul of the Logos has been infused in the form. But being the second aspect of divinity, the form then is the second aspect of form, which is the astral.
Right. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Cancer is on the cardinal cross. One arm is Aries, which is the sign of beginning, of commencement, of subjective life, of the prenatal stage or involution, and of the first step, either towards form taking or towards spiritual liberation. Another arm is Libra, the balance, choosing between, the beginning of the treading of the narrow razor-edged path to which the Buddha so frequently refers. Capricorn, the fourth arm of the cardinal cross, is the birth of the world savior, birth into the spiritual kingdom, and birth out of the world of matter into the world of being. So as we see with the whole cardinal cross, what we've got is involution, incarnation, expression, and inspiration. And they express the story of the cardinal cross in the heavens. This is, eventually, the cross of the initiate. The astrological symbol for the sign of Cancer, we're told, has no relation at all to the crab. It's actually composed, and that's the glyph that we use. It's composed of the two asses, the tails of those donkeys, and they link up in the gospel story with the story of the manger. Cancer, the constellation Cancer, is also related to the manger. In connection with the birth of Jesus, two asses appear. The one on which the Virgin rode down to Bethlehem prior to the birth, and the other on which she rode to Egypt after the birth. There are two stars in the constellation of Cancer that are known as the northern ass, or Ocellus Borealis, and the southern ass, or Ocellus Australis. Neither one of these stars are all that bright, as there are no bright stars at all in Cancer, no conspicuous or brilliant stars, because Cancer is a sign of hiding, of retreat behind that which has been constructed. There are actually 83 stars in this sign, and at the very center is the cluster that's called the manger. It's the official name is Prosepe. I'm sorry, Greek names I'm not all that great with. It's called by modern astronomers as the beehive. And that's another appropriate symbol for Cancer. It's a collective organization of the human family, and it's fitting for a mass sign, isn't it? So it's no accident what they call these things. At first, we don't recognize the intuition. It's faint sound, barely heard, just as this constellation is a very dim one. All that is to be found is a deep inner urge and a discontent which gradually becomes so strong that it lifts the hidden, struggling individual out of his environment of stabilized world condition and makes him an earnest aspirant. He knows no rest until he's emerged out of the water and climbed steadily on until he finds the summit of the mountain in Capricorn. Okay, that's the end of my official... Well, I got one more thing here. As we've seen so far, and for those of you who this is your first webinar, this is actually our fifth one. We had an introductory one, and then we had the first three signs. All of those are available on the Makara website. When Brett posts the link to this one, you'll be able to find the other ones there. I also post a copy of the slides, so you can look at that too. So we have that. But as we've seen so far, the first four preparatory signs, he was equipped with the faculty of mind in Aries, with desire in Taurus, a rise of that essential duality in Gemini, and then he enters the kingdom, the human kingdom in Cancer. So we're up to this one here. And next we'll start the physical plane struggle. Okay? So, that's today's presentation. The next one will be on Leo, and it'll be on the 3rd of August. So, okay, Yvonne? Yes, go ahead, Yvonne.
Hello. Okay, could you go back to the cardinal cross again? I didn't understand that part because we didn't have a slide on it on the screen.
Oh, okay. No.
What's the significance of Cancer being having a cardinal cross?
Well, Cancer is in the cardinal cross. The cardinal cross are the four cardinal signs. You know, they're the angles, the four angles in a chart. Aries, Cancer, Libra, and Capricorn. Okay?
Right.
Now, remember we have the modes of activity where we have all of the signs and we have the three different modes that we express in different ways. You know, cardinal is initiating and going forth. Fixed is the stubborn. And mutable is the changeable. Okay?
Yeah.
Those are the three modes. And so those are the three crosses that we have. We also have those three crosses that represent the evolution of an individual. You know, the mutable cross is the cross that ordinary man is on. The disciple is mounts the fixed cross and has all the tests of the fixed signs. And then the initiate mounts the cardinal cross at the third initiation. So that's something that's beyond most of us at this point. But there is, you have to look at it in context. You have to look at the quality and you have to look at the element. Okay? And the element is water and the quality is, the mode is part of the cardinal cross. So does that make more sense, or do you want me to go back through?
Yeah, it just sort of made sense. The Cancer is the first sign you incarnated, and I just thought it should be mutable cross since it was the beginning. Okay. I don't understand it yet, but I'll look it up.
Okay. Here.
Hi, BL.
Hi, Francis. Walter has something to say, and let me see. He probably can clarify it a little better. Walter, go ahead.
Hello?
Walter?
Yeah,
go ahead.
I found, interestingly, part about the Cancer glyph representing the two donkeys, which is interesting and new to me. Another interpretation of the Cancer glyph that I've learned about is that it represents two mammary glands, which shows how linked the sign Cancer is with the mother aspect and also the process of nurturing the baby into incarnation. And actually that reminds me of how, like Aquarius, in the sign of Aquarius, the two wavy lines are not waves as often thought, because Aquarius is an air sign and not a water sign, but rather the glyph of Aquarius, those are serpents, or serpents of knowledge, which are shared with the group and society.
I know. It's amazing. And number one, there's multiple connotations for these, as you've just pointed out. But it is amazing when you look at the symbology of that, when you look at the definitions of those glyphs, isn't it?
Indeed. And I understand that some of them have deep esoteric significance, like that I'm not even aware of, like the Capricorn glyph, I understand, has some huge,
right,
deep symbology to it.
Right. They tell us that... what we know of as the Capricorn glyph is not the proper one because it just has so much power to it that that has to be hidden from us for right now. There's so much symbology. But, you know, it's with everything else. These symbols mean one thing to someone at one level and something else to someone at a higher level.
Indeed.
Right. Francis has joined us. Francis, did you have something that you would like to add to Yvonne's question or anything?
Yeah, a couple of comments about the cardinal cross. The four cardinal signs are all initiatory in their quality. You know, Aries initiates the original impulse for coming into incarnation. Four signs before it actually happens in Cancer, which is also an initiating impulse. Libra initiates the reversal on the wheel, though it actually plays out in Scorpio. I mean, it actually manifests, you could say, in Scorpio. And then in Capricorn, you have the entrance into the fifth kingdom through the mountaintop. So it's also an initiating or a door. Of course, Cancer and Capricorn being polar opposites are the two gates. I'm sure you've talked about that before I got here.
Yeah.
So they each of them has this quality of the very highest and the very lowest. You know, you have the mass level on one end, which is represents instinct, and then you have the intuition on the other end of the spectrum. Both cardinal qualities, with the mutable and the fixed carrying the qualities that lie between those two. So it's one way of looking at the cardinal signs. They're in many ways the most mysterious of all the signs, and at the same time, the most obvious. I mean, look at this labor. It's said to be quite simple, you know, quite obvious, and yet it took him a year to do it. You know, I mean, which translates at least into a lifetime to do it, because he's dealing with sublimating his instinct into intuition, right? So.
Yeah, and that was one of the things that he was told at the very beginning, that it was both simple and hard. Let me see if I can pull up that slide again. Provide a test which will evoke his wisest choice. Let me see. Provide likewise a test of great simplicity upon the outer plane, and yet a test which will awaken on the inner side of life the fullness of his wisdom and the rightness of his power to choose. So,
right. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah. Did you discuss the Apollo Diana paradigm at all?
Yes. Yes.
You did. Okay. Fine. It's the higher lower mind kind of quality to it.
Well, we discussed the fact that Artemis was the moon in the form, and the instinct, that Diana was the intellect, and that Apollo was the intuition. That's what we discussed.
I see. Well, Apollo being a sun god also is manifest on the mental plane, but would be the higher mental, the last three subplanes. And indeed, where Diana stops and Apollo begins is that fourth subplane of the middle, where that temple exists. You know, that's where Hercules leaves Diana behind and is able to enter the temple of Apollo, which is literally the higher mental plane, wherein, you know, all light exists in order to receive that which comes from even higher, you know, from the Buddhic plane, which is pure intuition.
Right.
It's Eva here. I just wanted to add one little thing to what Francis opened up with in talking about the cardinal sign. For the people that are listening, when we think of the three crosses, and we always start with the mutable cross, when we say mutable to ourselves, we understand what mutable means. It has a specific meaning and connotation. We know it has to do with being flexible, with being changeable. So we know that all those signs that are on the mutable cross carry with that quality within them. And then we move to the next cross, which would be the fixed cross. And the word fixed also has a certain meaning and connotation in our minds. That which is fixed is immovable, isn't it? And that which is fixed can be stable, it can be concrete, it can be all those adjectives that we can use for fixity. Then we move to the cardinal. What does cardinal really mean to us? It doesn't really have that meaning. So that adds to the mystery that Francis made reference to. We think of cardinal as the bird being red. We think of a cardinal in a church as wearing red robes. So there's something about red and about power and about activity associated with cardinal. But really, we don't know what it really, really means. So there is that mystery automatically associated with all the signs that are cardinal. And And like Francis said, they do initiate something new and something quite deep and spiritual. And it is a lot of mystery surrounded with a lot of these signs. So anyway, I'll just leave it at that, that it isn't as easily grasped as that which is mutable and that which is fixed.
And that's because it is both below and above the threshold of most of us, you know.
Right.
We're not in mass consciousness anymore, so we don't resonate with that quality. And we're not in high initiatory, you know, Buddhic consciousness, though we're, you know, that's where we're headed. And
right.
So it just isn't part of our woof and warp, you could say.
Mm-hmm. Nicole, yeah. You had a comment that you wanted to make?
Yeah, thanks. I agree with Eva that, you know, the cardinal signs are something which is a little bit remote from us. And for me, cardinal signs have always been associated with the aspect of will, which we don't access as readily as the love aspect or the third aspect, intelligence. And if we notice, the four signs are on the hard line. Aries, Ray 1-7, Cancer
3-7, right.
Libra 3-7, Capricorn 1-5, 1-3, 5-7. So they're all on the hard line of will, and this is not an aspect that we that is developed first. Actually, it's the aspect within us which is last developed, and that's why it's associated with the initiate, because the initiate has developed intelligence and has already blended intelligence and love. And it's only once he's synthesized these two that he can access the will aspect or the first aspect of divinity. That's the way I've always understood the cardinal, and it took me quite a while to even get that slant. So whether I'm right or not, I don't know, but it makes sense to me.
Well, no, that's the way I understand it too, but I understand that more towards, you know, working towards the higher levels of consciousness, when in reality we still have to deal with them on the lower levels as well. And sometimes those are hard things to deal with, and sometimes they're easy things to deal with. Someone with a lot of Cancer, like me, I can be extremely sensitive, which is a lower level thing, in a variety of ways, physically especially, to lotions and soaps and things like that. Also, I can get my feelings hurt real bad because of it. But also because of the cardinal signs that I have within my chart, I'm very initiatory. I'm a self-initiated person. I can start things, and I can keep them going, and I can organize things, and all of those are nice faculties that I get from my cardinal signs, from the seventh ray that flows through the Capricorn and Cancer in me.
And the Moria Federation is better off for it.
Well, thank you. So, you know, at all different levels we have the good and the bad with all of these signs, with the crosses. It's the same with the elements. So we've had some very good discussion on this. I really appreciate the chiming in of everyone who's helped. Does anybody else want to say anything before we say good night to everyone, or good morning in a couple of your cases? Okay, I'm going to unmute everybody for a really quick goodbye, y'all. Okay?
Goodbye.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, BL.
Thank you all.
Great.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you, BL.
Thank you.
And Jared?
Thanks.
Jared, can you hear us? Jared, are you there? Oh, we never got to hear you. But, okay. I'm going to stop the recording now. So goodbye, everybody.
Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you.